Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey folks, before we start, really exciting news. We now have CME available from ACRAC. That's right. You can get AMA PRA Category 1 credit for listening to ACRAC and then filling out just a quick survey question that will take you not more than about 30 seconds to a minute. Those links are at the website, acrac.com. In each show notes, you can see right under the description, there will be a bold CME with a link. You click on that link. It's a small cost for each credit, much less than you would pay to go to a conference or get the 20 or 30 or 40 credits that you need for the year. You can do them one at a time for each episode that you listen to and get a full credit for just listening to an ACRAC episode and then filling out this quick question. This is powered by CMEify. It's using AI technology to bring the right education to the right place at the right time. And it really is great. You can do this in just a minute or less and get credit. So if you are out there looking for a way to get PRA Category 1 credit for your CME requirements, or if you're already getting it somewhere but you're already listening to ACRAC anyway and you'd like to get it from this, now you can. Every episode can get you a credit, so you can get more than 200 credits from ACRAC episodes by listening and then clicking on that link on the website at acrac.com. All right, now on with the show. Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and we've got a fantastic show for you today. I'm really thrilled that I've got with me someone who's really involved in social media, education, and anesthesia, and thinking about alternative asynchronous ways to teach. This is a little bit of a meta podcast since we're on a podcast talking about different forms of asynchronous education, but I think it's going to be really interesting. And I'm thrilled to have with me Dr. David Convasar. David is currently doing a combined critical care and cardiac fellowship at Mass General Hospital and has just really kind of gotten involved in a lot of interesting educational stuff along the way, in addition to, of course, working very hard clinically. So I'm going to let David explain that a little more. But David, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Wolpaw. Jed, I'm super excited to be here. And, you know, I'm super excited to talk about social media in anesthesia education and you know, general medical education. Nowadays. So I guess a little bit about myself.
Yes. And hold on one second, because I do want you to do that. And I just want to make one shout out, because I think this, I've been trying to figure out where to plug this, because it's great. And I think this is the perfect podcast to do it on, the perfect episode, since we're talking about asynchronous web resources. So if people out there are interested in some really great free neuroanesthesia and critical care resources, I just want to point folks to the Society for Neuroscience and Anesthesiology and Critical Care. That's SNACC, S-N-A-C-C. Their website at snacc.org. There's a lot of great stuff there. They've got, it's all free. They've got neuroanesthesia quizzes you can take and learn from. They've got this whole education corner. And then they have a new podcast. It's called the SNACC Podcast, S-N-A-C-C. You can get it on Google, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. And again, free and a great resource if you're either on a neuroanesthesia rotation or an neuro-ICU rotation, or you're thinking about doing a fellowship in those areas. Really interesting stuff. So check it out. All right, let's get back to David. David, tell us about you and kind of what, you know, I told folks what you're doing in terms of fellowship, but talk a little bit about how you got where you are and where you're going.
Yeah. So I'm actually from South Jersey, and I thought when I went to medical school, I was going to be a trauma surgeon, and found out that most of medicine and trauma is people falling off of their toilets on Coumadin. It's not as exciting as I thought it was going to be, and found anesthesia and found that the kind of 10, 15 minute procedures that I didn't know they actually did, were really appealing. And this very intimate relationship between a patient and an anesthesiologist, because there's no one between you and the patient, right? You are the physician making the decision. You're the nurse pushing the med. You're the pharmacist who's deciding, you know, there's no epic pop-up for you didn't dilute this insulin right. And so it makes this very interesting relationship between the patient, where you are all aspects of their other medical care. So I found the anesthesia. I went through. I said, there's no way I'm ever doing cardiac and critical care because I don't like rounding and I don't like long cases. And lo and behold, I enjoyed rounding in a surgical ICU, and cardiac and echo is amazing. So I did my residency at Rutgers at New Jersey Medical School in North Jersey, where I did medical school. Did my applications, wound up coming up to the Massachusetts General Hospital for a 2-year fellowship in critical care and cardiothoracic anesthesia. Just took my ICU boards and hoping that I don't have to retake them. And in the meantime, I'm trying to learn echo from some of the best people I've really, ever been honored to work with.
Yeah, that's great. And we were just talking about Dr. Jay Crowley, who's one of your attendings and was a year behind me in residency. And I just have very fond memories of Jay. And if he's ever going to listen to this, I'll give him a little shout out. He's a great guy. One of the funniest people I've ever known. And I'm sure a fan. He was a fantastic resident. I'm sure he's a fantastic attending.
Who I want to be.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me, that's great. And tell me a little bit about, you've done, in addition to obviously a lot of really hard, intense clinical work, you've created some YouTube content and an Instagram account. Tell us a little bit about what that is and how you decided to do that.
Yeah, so I found that there were topics in anesthesia that were, they eluded me as a, like, I never understood why we heated and pressurized des flooring. Sitting and reading a textbook felt really dense, and I couldn't get really solid explanations that explain the basic physics, even with mechanisms of breathing, how the pleural spaces pull away from one another and you increase your area, and so pressure is force over area. Things that I felt like I should know, I couldn't pull up a YouTube video to just have somebody explain that to me. And I've also found over the years that we use a very antiquated model of medical education in med school, and even now, where I sit in a room and somebody talks off of a PowerPoint slide to me for 1 to many hours. And that's not what I need, and it's not what I want. And we're kind of conditioned, I think, at this stage in time where, I grew up playing video games, I grew up with television, I grew up with, multiple stimuli, and I want to listen to something for 5 or 10 minutes, get the points that I need to know, understand it, and kind of move on. And so I wanted to try and create a resource. And to anyone who's listening, it's called Count Backwards from 10. The shtick was that's what we tell patients before they go to sleep, and all the video content was supposed to be 10 minutes or less, was I was looking to make a resource to answer questions in a way that I had that I wish somebody explained to me when I was a CA1 or a CA2 or doing things like that. And so I kind of emulated the people like Dr. Hussein Sitar, who does Pathoma for medical school, and people from Khan Academy and other kind of educators that we find that are not necessarily parts of medical schools, or they are, but they don't just exist. They do very well because people want to go watch them. And I found that anesthesia was something that, at least in my opinion at the time, was lacking in explanations to these things. And, the second gas effect, super confusing when you read it in a textbook. But if you can get a solid explanation, it doesn't take more than 5 minutes. And so that was kind of my goal. And now it's been more tailored towards critical care and cardiac content, and hoping to expand on it, once I'm done.
Well, that's great. I think you're exactly right. We still are teaching in the way we've always been taught. I mean, we're starting to break away, but in many ways, the model of education is still the one that's been around forever. And yet students are growing up in a very different world with a very different set of tools at their disposal, and possibly a very different attention span, and so I think the idea that we should not think about different tools to use for education doesn't really make a lot of sense. So I love that you're thinking about this, that, Count Backwards from 10. I love the title, and it's a great idea. I've seen some of the content that looks great. And I would encourage people to check that out, as well as many other models out there. I can't imagine. I mean, when I was going through med school, everyone listened to the Goulian lectures. Yep. And, my understanding is that now that's kind of been supplanted a little bit by Pathoma maybe, but I bet you can't find a medical student who doesn't know what Pathoma is, right?
So there's exactly.
Just ubiquitous resources. All right. So let's talk about how the fact that this is out there, you and many others are doing this kind of work, and there's a ton of good content. How does that translate to folks who are in residency looking for, a way amidst their hard clinical work to try to learn all the stuff they have to learn?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting idea because, the old model of medicine, not that it's old because we still do it, but you know, there's this expectation in medicine, and especially in residency, that you go, you work for 8, 10, 12, 14 hours a day, you're on 24-hour call, and that you're then supposed to go home, you're supposed to have a normal social life, have a family, you're supposed to exercise, eat right, get 8 hours of sleep a night, you're supposed to read up on your cases tomorrow and talk to your attending, then you're supposed to read about all the content for those things. And it's like, something's got to give. There's not enough hours in the day to be able to successfully do that. And Miller is obviously an incredible book. I tend to use it as a reference at this point. But even now, like you mentioned, being supplanted by things that, you know, UpToDate is literally constantly being updated. You're not going to find a republished version of Miller every couple of months. And so with all those things, people are looking, at least anecdotally and in my opinion, for ways to shrink that time so that they can go ahead and do that. And as we understand more about medicine, it's not that we don't need to understand the basics and kind of the underlying tone of what's going on. You should understand pressures and how it affects, say, putting BiPAP on somebody with CHF exacerbation. But when somebody's learning it either for an exam or you need to know the steps for an intra-op emergency, they're looking for ways that they can listen while they're doing other things and say, okay, this is what a pneumothorax in the operating room looks like. These are the signs you need to look for and why, without having to sit down and read a textbook that's going to derive equations about how, you know, the law of Laplace works with, you know, LV filling. And that might be something that you get to, but in my mind, there is some amount of layering. Like from my standpoint, my knowledge, honestly, in regional, for example, is very limited. I'm not particularly talented at it, and it doesn't interest me as much. But I needed to know certain things to be a competent anesthesiologist, just like I learned basics for critical care and then worked more into it as I kind of went along. And so what social media, I think, allows people to do is you get educators from kind of all over the world. You get people, you know, like yourself who can be on a podcast and somebody in Asia or somebody in Australia or a new resident can sit and listen and be like, what's this person talking about that's cutting edge? You know, I listened to Lorenzo Berra. You had him on 1 or 2 weeks ago, who's one of my attendings here. And I get to work with him every day or constantly. But he's a world expert in nitric oxide and ARDS. To have somebody else thousands of miles away be able to learn from the same kinds of people and have that all over the place and have it in almost real time is super important. And we saw it, especially when COVID happened, was people being able to share content and share findings and share studies instantaneously. And so not only from an education standpoint of being able to publish resources, explanations in ways that, again, I wish that people had explained certain things to me a certain way. And if I'm limited to the attendings that I work with or the senior residents, that's it. But now I can hop on Instagram and find a video from somebody that I've watched a couple of times. And it's like, they nailed it. And so from an education standpoint, it offers this massive kind of open resource foam med type situation that really, I think with so many different, I'm sorry, I'm rambling, styles of learning, you're going to find the way that works for you and be able to kind of follow along with that those people.
I love that. I love the idea that people can kind of, and this is really thinking about adult learners who need to have some control over their own learning, as opposed to, you know, you can probably do what you want with a classroom of kindergartners and they're going to be like sponges. But adults, you know, and so I love that for adult learners, the idea that you're laying out, and you mentioned FOAM Med, free open access medical education, right, is that hopefully we are continuing to develop this just huge plethora of options and people can find what works for them. And you alluded to this idea that, you know, you could read, so you brought up blocks. You, let's say you have to do a block one day, right? You could read the 50-page chapter in Big Miller about it, or you could go online and find a 5-minute video that'll show you exactly, you know, of the block being done and things to think about. New England Journal, for example, has great videos and a lot of different procedures, and there's many more. So let me ask you this. I mean, that sounds so appealing, and a lot of people do that, right? And is there anything lost? I mean, if you compare reading that 50-page chapter to watching that 5-minute video, is there anything lost when it comes to either your ability to perform that block or maybe your overall development? And I'm not asking this because I think there is. I don't know the answer. I'm interested to hear your thoughts.
So I think there's, with everything, no matter what, there's always going to be a good and a bad side to it. You know, you drink too much water because you got to stay hydrated and your sodium gets low. You need to take, there's always going to be a give and take and a downside to everything. And I think there's a couple of them, especially with social media and things like that. The big plus is, like you said, you want to see a block. You don't have to look at static images. You can watch somebody physically do it on the NYSORA website. Or on their app and look up a video exactly how to do it and what routes they're blocking and what will happen as a result. And it's really fantastic. But there's a reason that those chapters exist. There's a reason that that 50-page chapter on the, you know, supraclavicular block exists, and it's because there's a lot more to it than just giving some numbing medication, putting your needle in and injecting. It's kind of like the old adage of, you know, the guy who gets paid, they pay him $10,000 to fix a boat, and he goes and he looks at the boat and he looks around and then he bangs on it in one place and the boat works again. And like, I paid you all this money to fix my boat and it took you 30 seconds. Like, you're not paying me for the 10 seconds it took me. You're paying me for everything that I understood behind it. And so it's super nice to, you know, maybe that touches me more is doing central lines for cardiac. Getting to watch a video on somebody doing a central line is phenomenal because I can emulate that. I can see exactly how it is. But at the same time, when you go and look at a ICU textbook chapter on doing central lines, the subtleties, angle of access, not over rotating, problems and problem solving, different ways to check that you're in line, the things, what could accidentally happen. You might not be able to follow your needle when you're the carotid. The things that you're not going to see necessarily in that 5-minute, 8-minute video are what exists in these textbooks. And it's kind of all that stuff that, well, I don't, and it's kind of why I don't think people necessarily need to read all of Miller. I certainly didn't. But when there were topics that I was interested in and wanted to become more adept in, I would start and say, okay, how do you do a central line? All right, let's go look at an ICU textbook and see what they have to say about it, and then kind of build on top of that. And so one, the big thing I think is lost is you lose that depth because, you know, we're looking for the fastest and easiest way to kind of keep our lives moving. And when we're so focused, especially nowadays, on tests and examinations, we just care about, you know, what are the highlights? What am I going to, you know, how many reviews are like, these are the buzzwords you're going to hear. This is what you need to be aware of. And it's not like understanding the pH chemical reaction of putting, you know, bicarb into lidocaine and what happens with the protons, because clinically, that doesn't matter as much, but it's what differentiates, like getting you to that next level. And I think that's a big thing that's lost.
Yeah, I think you put it really well. Thank you. So let me now ask you to move to talking about social media, specifically in anesthesiology education, right? You kind of talked about a lot of the advantages and ways that are worthwhile thinking about what's out there in the broad sense of medical education. How does this apply if we drill down to our specialty?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things. Believe it or not, there's a lot of papers out there on medical education, anesthesia, and the use of social media. And I've been trying to figure out how to study it. Turns out it's a lot more complicated to study education because, you know, you can't double blind people to watching a video or not. And a lot of it is surveys. How did you feel you retained this? Or in your sample size, if you're trying to test a residency, you have 30 residents that are going to do things one way or the other. So it's very interesting to read about how the studies are done. But they look at things like there was a paper that I have, you know, pulled up from the British Medical Journal from 2019 that kind of looked at how using social media for education, sharing information ends up getting beyond the kind of academic journals that we use, you know, and how it gets more information to people in a shorter amount of time than it did before, which is great because I certainly don't want to sit and read Anesthesia and Analgesia cover to cover along with The Lancet and X amount of other things. And there was another one in the British Journal from 2015 that I think actually looked at Twitter as a platform for, like I had mentioned before, fast dissemination and public forum discussion from everybody to be able to talk about things like that. And so within the field of anesthesia, not to say that it's changing rapidly, you know, I'm sure many of us use Propranolol and go to sleep, but things like neuroprotection, things like using BIS monitors and new technologies out there, all everything that comes out with teratogens, new drugs that are started, you know, it's a great way to be able to learn about that new kind of pharmacology, the new kind of studies that are coming out. But it's a great way for somebody somewhere, like I mentioned, in anesthesia, to sit and listen to your podcast here in Europe and listen to you talk to a world leader or a world expert or somebody in a field and get a different perspective, get those kinds of things. The other side of it, though, I think the more sinister side to social media and education in anesthesia is, and this was a big problem that you had kind of brought up to me when I first started, was how do you know who is telling you anything that's correct? Who is this random person? Who is this David, who's a fellow, talking to me about this thing? And you find a distinct lack of sources on the internet. And it's very difficult to kind of muddle through. What's this person telling me? How do I know that this is right? I'm going to go and talk to my attending. Like, well, I read on Instagram last night that, you know, deep hypothermia causes this thing. And it's like, they're going to look at you with two eyes. Like, did you read a paper on this? Did you read a textbook? You know, no, I just saw it on Twitter. You're like, who is this person? And it becomes a big problem because we almost look at it through this lens of, you know, headings. Like, how many people these days actually read through journals? They look at the abstract and they say, oh, great, the new targeted temperature stuff is just leave them normothermic and don't let them get fevers. Didn't bother to read the population, don't know how the study was performed, don't know why that doesn't apply to your patient. And so on one hand, it's really impressive to understand complex physiologic topics and make them simple, even with TikTok that are like a minute long, or here's a clever way to remember something. But the other side is you have no clue a lot of times the authority or what anybody's saying is actually a thing or is right.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that that you've hit right on the head what the challenges are. And there was an interesting paper, I want to say maybe it was in Academic Medicine, but it was a few years ago. But they looked at podcast listening and they found that one of the drawbacks, there were a lot of positives, but one of the drawbacks they identified was this idea that some residents reported they would kind of say to somebody, whether it's intending or resident, oh, you know, yeah, we should do this. And they'd say, oh, yeah, I agree. That's definitely the right way to do it. And they'd say, oh, yeah, you know, what is your, where'd you read about that? And they say, oh, I didn't read about it. I heard it on a podcast. And they'd say, how about you? They say, yeah, I heard it on the podcast. So everyone kind of, you know, everyone is saying they should do a certain thing, but everyone is just listening to the same podcast, right? And I think in emergency medicine, EM rap is certainly has been for a long time, and I think still is really just this incredibly dominant podcast. It's great. I remember listening to it when I was in emergency medicine as an intern, and it, you know, it's so ubiquitous in that field that people take it as almost like the New England Journal. You see something in it, you hear something in it, and you assume it's right. Now, those guys do a great job, and I'm sure what they are saying, what they're saying is evidence-based, or they probably are saying, if it's just opinion, they're identifying that. But, you know, that is a potential drawback, is that it's easy just to say, oh, I heard this, it must be right. But, of course, there's no guarantee that it is.
Of course, and you know, people try to find, and the other thing is, the audience that you get. It's really easy for somebody with thousands of followers, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of followers, to put something out there and it just be grossly incorrect. And you're like, now you have thousands of eyes on this thing that they didn't, you know, read or they didn't look back on. Not to say everyone does it. You know, I've certainly made mistakes in my drawings or writings. You know, I remember when I first spoke to you when I was first starting out, and you're like, yeah, you know, this was right, you know, 10 years ago, but the newest stuff. And you're like, I was like, oh, I really have to go back and read this before I kind of get it out there. And so you kind of get this headline learning, which, like I said, can be really great when you're looking for what the quick and dirty for something is, but is can be almost dangerous to some degree when you're trying to apply that without. Goes back to the same idea of getting to that next level, that reading that textbook or reading that journal article and knowing why they're doing it.
Yeah. So let's go through some of the real kind of highlight advantages and disadvantages, which we've kind of been talking about. But when you think about the real pros of this, ubiquitous set of resources that are out there, what that we haven't touched on would you really highlight as, these are things that are just good and that people should consider when they're thinking about their own education?
Yeah, I think one is you have it instantaneously in your fingertips. I don't have Miller in the operating room, but I know that I have, you know, the emergency medicine or the emergency, you know, things screenshotted or flagged or whatever it is in my pocket in real time, immediately. And in a way that I understand, you know, picture format, in a drawing and like, you know, bullet points, because I searched out, you know, the way to do this, and the way the person was going to teach it to me that I liked. So I think the easy availability in a field like anesthesia, where when things go wrong, they go wrong fast. You're not talking about giving vancomycin. They're like, oh, their creatinine's getting worse. Let's follow it up tomorrow and hydrate them. It's patient is desaturating, tube is in, and I don't know what's going on, and you need to figure out your pathway or whatever it is you're going to do about it. And so having that accessibility and having them at your fingertips in an instant and in a way that speaks to you, I think is super, super important. Two, it also allows for almost real-time evaluation of things. Back during COVID, people would be rounding and someone would be like, listen, something just came up on Twitter that they did this study out here and they were trying this, and it would change practice almost immediately. And so having that ability, not just from an education standpoint, but translating social media to its use in a clinical forum, you know, worldwide changes in clinical, things happened right away. And that was important because it also made things that maybe weren't so great. You know, you had the ivermectin stuff that came out and people were like, okay, we're going to study this because everyone's talking about it. And then, you know, we can be done with it. So I think accessibility, I think having, you know, kind of a worldwide forum and discussion with large enough eyes is super important. And then, you know, like we mentioned, finding that person that speaks to you and teaches the way that, you know, is best for you to learn. The cons, again, as I mentioned, is how do you distill? I think that's the biggest thing, because there's a infinitum of resources. Is how do you pick a reliable resource? How do you know that this person talking about balloon pumps? And a lot of times, at least, again, still my opinion, is there are resources on YouTube that have 500,000 views. And it's not because people, you know, maybe it's because they like the drawings, but a lot of times it's because they found that the way that something was explained was, one, correct and could be corroborated in some way, but two, it was done in a way that, you know, was good for them. MedCram, for example, is like one of my favorites if I ever have to reference something. And it's almost kind of like a masses type deal, where it wouldn't be the top of YouTube and it wouldn't have 500,000 views in the last year if what they were doing wasn't correct or wasn't good. And so it almost helps, you know, in social media distill that kind of idea of almost capitalistic education, where whatever the best thing is going to be is going to kind of, you know, pop up there. And so I think, again, rambling and kind of going around it, is finding, I think the biggest drawback is how do you know what you're getting is
right. Good. Hang in there. We'll be right back.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And I think that makes a lot of sense. I guess the cautionary note would be, and this is probably not that common, but that you could, of course, have some blooper or something in a video that made it funny and therefore had 500,000 views, right? But that's probably much more common in general media, not so much in medical specific stuff. But what advice? I mean, one thing is, sure, I think it's worthwhile to look at, you know, how ubiquitously listened to or watched something is. And if that, you know, is consistently getting 500,000 or millions of views, there's something to it, right? It may be that it's funny or, you know, kind of, you know, entertaining, but it may well also be that it's been shown to be right. But what else would you recommend that people do to kind of try to verify that a resource they found online is actually worthwhile? I mean, one thing, sure, is to look at how many people have used it. What else?
I think vetting the resources is probably the hardest part of all of it. And it's the most time consuming. And honestly, I don't know how many people listening to this actually sit down and read journal articles anymore. It's really hard. I like to think I'm pretty good at it, and I'm terrible. Like when you look at, most people are doing these studies and really like, I'll read something in the New England Journal, and then 2 weeks later I'll see the letter to the editor. I'm like, how did you even, I don't even know what you're saying because I didn't understand that from the paper clearly. And so that might also not be a great way for a lot of people to verify and do that, but it's good to at least reference. It's good to say, does this thing apply to my patients today, or was that only studied in, pregnant patients or patients who are Trendelenburg in the OR, insufflated? So I think one, just looking that something that you're watching or listening to has a source is the most important thing. Even if you're not necessarily going to go to it, at least you can always look back and say, they said this, I can go back and verify, I can go back and look. But if something doesn't have a source, I think you get into some very murky waters of there's almost no way to know if what they're saying is correct. And then beyond that, again, there are some things you're going to take with a grain of salt and maybe something that you learned multiple times, you saw in textbooks. If I watch a video about a superclav block, and I hear something on a podcast or I watch a YouTube video, I'm like, yeah, I've heard that before. This is something that tends to repeat itself. You can usually take that to the bank to some degree, but also recognizing that stuff like that changes. The data maybe on postoperative nausea and vomiting with nitrous isn't what it was 10 years ago. The use of SWANs in heart failure now, had a new paper last year that said it might actually help as opposed to all of it. So I think the next step is to boil down what is and is not important to you, and that you're willing to take the time in a very hustling, bustling medical world right now, what you're willing to sit down for 30, 40 minutes and say, this article came out, or I watched this video and this article was referenced. I want to sit down and read about this most recent, targeted temperature management trial.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think part of it also probably depends on what you're using it for. So if you read a resource online or listen to a podcast and you decide tomorrow I'm doing this with my patient in the OR, you really should be verifying that. You should be looking at the sources. You should be looking up independent sources to verify. See, is this just someone's idea? Is it something that was, listed in just a case report that somebody did one time? But if all you're saying is, that sounded interesting, I think tomorrow I'll bring it up with my attending when we're chatting. If you're a trainee listening and you know, that I think is fine, right? If your attending says, I've never heard of that, then that might ring a little bell. Maybe this isn't so well regarded, although it could be, and they just don't know about it. But, so it's one, you need one sort of threshold to sort of have it enter your conversation, a very higher threshold if you're going to actually start acting on it. And I would argue actually that there's probably never a time, and this doesn't, for trainees, you're obviously going to make a plan with your attending, but for folks out there who are already in practice, I would argue there's probably never a time where the first time you hear about something by either seeing it on some random website or hearing it on a podcast should be what changes your practice. It might make you curious, and as you said, might make you go delve into the sources that were included on that podcast or that make you look up articles on your own to see what's being done and then talk to colleagues about if they've heard of this and what they're being done. But, what I love about what's out there in terms of open access medical education is it can be a conversation starter, right? It can make you think, that's interesting. I wonder if it's being done, and then make you look into it more. It shouldn't necessarily make you start doing it the next day.
And if you look at things like Doximity, which are, I wouldn't necessarily call it social media, but it almost is you have these giant forums, for critical care. And they're like, what do you think of, this ventilation mode and this paper that came out. But I wholeheartedly agree. And even when you look at what changes and adjusts people's practice, I've been to conferences and I said, I think there was one, they were talking about reperfusion injury in dogs after cardiac arrest. That was what they were looking at in the paper. And like, and it showed that when you put them on 100% oxygen, I know they've looked at this in a number of times, that you actually have worse outcomes, be it from free oxygen radicals or whatever it was. It's like, how many things have to come out or have to happen before you're willing to change your practice to not do that to a person. Whereas now it's like, oh, I watched this on YouTube, you know, let's try doing the central line this way. Or what if we try this vent mode, APRB, because I read that, you know, somebody did a podcast on it one day. And I think it has just as much helpful and benefits as it does potential harm, especially when you have somebody who's doing something and they've been doing it for many years or they have experience with it. For somebody to just hear it and be like, oh, that sounds interesting, I'm going to try it. It's like, you know.
Right. So can you share an example or two of things that, you know, you felt like you were able to get a grasp on or understand through the use of social media that you just hadn't really been able to grasp through traditional methods of education?
Definitely interesting question. I would say that, you know, it kind of started, have you heard of Sketchy Micro and Sketchy Farm?
I have heard of.
Mm-hmm. Flashcard sets that use pictures and images. And I think there's a good amount of data that says that images and pictures and things help you remember things sometimes better because you can associate them. We remember things that we see sometimes a little bit better than things that we hear. It's, you know, why you can tell me what happened during a movie during the entire time. You can't necessarily recite all of the lines. And so I think there have been a lot of things, especially looking at pressures in the heart. That's been a big one. I can't tell you how many times I've memorized the pressures of the heart until I watched a YouTube video and they're like, explain to me in a very succinct manner, you know, pressure is force over area. Anytime a valve is open, the pressure has to equalize. And all of a sudden I'm like, so a CVP is the same thing as the right atrial pressure, is the same thing as the right ventricular diastolic pressure, because it's all one big open chamber. I'm like, nobody has said that to me ever. I'm sure I've read it in some various forms in textbooks, but it hasn't gotten there. Even most recently, again, PTE Masters, which is, you know, done by Tommy Burch at the Tufts, which is basically the Bible for what everyone uses for studying their echo boards. The ASE, the American Society of Echocardiography guidelines for doing echo, is very dense. And to sit there and try to read to evaluate like a stenotic lesion of the aortic valve, I'm like, oh my God, I don't know what half of these things are. I don't understand what they're saying. This is way too much physics for me. But I go and I watch this video from Tommy and I'm like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. You know, as things get towards a smaller hole, they're going to start driving, you know, going to move faster to keep it. And it clicks. And so beyond that is the implementation of videos and pictures that are not necessarily available when you're reading a book or looking at something. Not to say they don't have pictures, but it's very different to watch a procedure online or watch how you cannulate ECMO or watch how you do something as opposed to reading in a book the steps or a cartoon, because cartoons are very different than real life pictures. A real life echo image and learning how to do measurements is very different than a diagram. And so that, at least in my experience most recently, in the cardiac world, has been being able to watch videos on how they do valvular surgery, because I'm not in the field, I can't see it. And when I'm trying to understand why they're doing what they're doing, what a ring looks like in the field, why, using social media, I've been able to kind of get a better understanding of things that I didn't otherwise get from looking at one of the many, many cardiac surgery books.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think you've hit it really, I think, correctly in that some things you can read about and just get. Other things, you need a picture, which you can get a picture in a textbook. Other things, a video is going to be way better. And other things, you know, having somebody explain it, even better. So it happens to me all the time. I'm attending in the ICU and, you know, I'm not a surgeon. So a lot of times a patient may come out with some very unusual anatomy. They've connected things and, you know, not your typical way. And I'll ask the surgeon or the surgical fellow or resident to draw it out. And having it drawn out is helpful. But even more helpful is that they draw it out, right? And they can do this so well. And then they sit there with the piece of paper and they explain to you what they've drawn and why and what's hooked up where and what means what. And that you can't get in a textbook. You really can only get from either someone in person or a video where they're walking you through it on the video itself. Maybe you can approximate it with an audio explanation if you can somehow picture it in your mind. But, you know, really having the opportunity for all those things is pretty unique.
You mean when vascular surgery comes out with a FEVAR, fenestrated FEVAR and snorkels to the renals, you don't know what's going on? You know?
Exactly. Exactly.
Same thing. We draw it up on the wall so we all know what's going on. And, you know, it's like exactly like you said, you don't get that from a book. I can read. I know what a FEVAR is. I know the fenestration they can put in various places. But it doesn't mean anything to me because that's not my clinical field. And I don't know why they're doing it. I don't know how they're doing it. Even something as simple as a purse string suture in the aorta. When I was learning about going on to bypass, it's like, what, like, do you just cut the aorta and plug and pray? And like, how do you do this? And it wasn't until somebody, like you said, sat down and said, we put a needle in here, 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 here. We put a tourniquet over it. We make a cut, put our cannula in and pull it and cinch it tight. I'm like, I could have read textbooks for days and I would not have understood that. And I think social media is what allows people to make that jump, that surgeon coming out of the OR and explaining that kind of connection, which I think is a great way to, you know, compare it.
Absolutely. Do you have examples you'd recommend to folks of things that you really think are great resources within the just universe of options out there? And let's speak within our field. So, you know, education and anesthesia, things you'd recommend people check out?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and like you said, it's very meta. But, you know, watch ACRAC. Anybody who's listening to this, you know, like I said, Lorenzo, who was on, you know, 2 weeks ago, is a world expert in you know, ARDS and COVID and nitric oxide. And so listen to, you know, the things that are out there from you know, yourself and Dr. Wolpa and things like that. I think people out there, Rishi, many of you may know him, especially if you have Instagram, Kumar, you know, has been doing this since he was a resident. Basically, I think, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think kind of as he was learning about stuff, he would take pictures of, you know, drugs and be like, this is how I'm learning about it. And sharing kind of what I'm learning, kind of the same thing I'm doing. So Rishi is absolutely phenomenal for many things, anesthesia, critical care, cardiac related. There's a gentleman named Eddie Joe, who's actually a friend of mine and very talented on Instagram. And basically what he does is, you know, like I mentioned, I don't have time necessarily to read all the critical care journals that come out, but he does. And he, or not that he has time, but he does it and he reads them and he says, here's the high points and low points. Here's how they did the study. Here's why they did the study. Here's what they found. Here's the flaws. Here's what they could have done better. And he tells you, you know, kind of the important things. So that's Eddie Joe. And he has a website. And he, I think, is starting a podcast as well for critical care topics. So I think Rishi, Eddie Joe are great. I'm obviously shamelessly pitching myself a count backwards from 10 from anybody listening. Sure. And I'm hoping that as these things continue to grow, you know, anesthesia, which is a field that's been, you know, I don't want to say in the back, but it's something where, you know, people who go to med school tend to be type A personalities. They're like, I'm going to study. I'm going to be, you know, I'm the person. It's no longer your show. And, you know, you're a guardian angel. And so that appeal of getting out there and talking about, like, you know, when people, all they think is we just push propofol, we put somebody to sleep, and you're like, all right, see you later. You know, we'll wake you up at the end. But when you think about it, what's the one thing every patient asks? It's always, am I going to wake up at the end? It's the most thing that they're concerned about. And so I think that I'm hoping that as the field, as things become more percutaneous, as there's less openness, anesthesia has the opportunity to do things like cannulate ECMO or put in balloon pumps and do devices and things like that, like you see in Europe, places in the South. I think Emory, all of the ECMO services from VV ECMO, I think at Penn, are all intensivists and anesthesiologists. Is as we kind of do more and more, it becomes a more mainstream kind of thing that people are excited to get into. Resources will continue to pop up because people are going to be like, this is really cool. I want to know what I can do and how to get involved. So I think those are the big ones.
Yeah, great. Well, thanks for sharing those. And there's, you know, I would encourage people to take a look. There's great, you know, the Depth of Anesthesia podcast out of MGH is a great one that I think they do a really nice job. We hosted one of their first episodes on our feed. And, you know, they do a really nice job of looking at the evidence behind a lot of common practices and whether or not there is any evidence. So I think that's fantastic. And there's many, many more. So people will hopefully go and leave in the comments their own thoughts and recommendations. All right. So we've talked about a lot of pros, and certainly I'm biased and think there's a ton of pros to this. We've also talked about some cons. We kind of highlighted the fact that you have to be careful of knowing what you're getting, and that if there's, you know, you shouldn't just take it for granted that what someone says on a podcast or writes on a blog is accurate. Are there other cons you think it's important to point out to people when they're thinking about getting medical education through this kind of format?
You know, I'll be honest, I've been pretty, focused on just the idea of is what I'm hearing correct or incorrect? And maybe it's been hard as a biased individual to be like, why wouldn't somebody want to come and look at my content and do that? I would think that one thing, now that I'm thinking about it, is lack of structure or consistency. Is if you want to learn more about something, and I'm absolutely guilty of this, is, you know, I took a week and spoke about, evaluation of the mitral valve or mitral regurgitation, mitral stenosis. But this week I'm talking about perfusion and what happens to the mitral valve. Like, there's so much more about it. And it might be that you're going to find these like blips on somebody's page where they talk about this drug one day that you think is really cool, and you're using cyanocobalamin for severe hypotension one day. And you're like, I was just learning about pressors. Like, where is the rest of it? So maybe I think kind of in speaking and thinking about it, a con is that, you know, maybe you want more of whatever it is and it simply isn't there because it's not a textbook. There's not a table of contents to my webpage. There's just random videos I put up because they were topics that I wish I had been taught one way. Or maybe it's just, hey, someone saw this machine. You know, I watched the machine the other day for a transplant where they put the heart on basically on ECMO or on bypass, and they wheeled it in. And I was like, it looked like they sous vide the heart. And I'm like, I could read about that one day, but I want to learn more about this. And, you know, that's all you get. You know, you get a kind of a snapshot on social media. It's not kind of more than that. So I think that's probably one of the other big things, but maybe you have some thoughts that, you know, maybe make me think a little bit more.
No, you know, I think that, there are a few, right? So the main one, I think, is exactly what we've talked a lot about, which is that you can't, you should never take anything for granted, even if it's published in the New England Journal. But at least if it's in a major journal, you can trust that it's been through peer review. People have looked at it. People who are very smart who have thought about this. So, you know, that doesn't mean every paper, and obviously major journals retract paper, so it doesn't mean every paper is right. And you should make sure you think hard about everything and read them carefully. But, you know, there's a different level of something that's just stuck on a random blog versus something published in a major journal. So, you know, if it's on a blog, if it's in a podcast, I think you have to ask yourself, as we've talked about, you know, how do I know this is right? And the only way to really know is to double check it, right? With people, with sources, et cetera. So that's a big one. I think also, you know, there is the idea that you might read something or listen to something that is right, but you don't yet have the knowledge to put it in context. And so you might not use it well. So, you know, for example, and this might not make a ton of sense because I'm making it up off the top of my head, but let's say that you watched a podcast and you figured out, or you watched a video and you figured out how to do a certain block. But maybe in that video, even though they correctly explained how to do it, they didn't talk about contraindications or certain patient populations where that might not be a good block to use. You decide to go do it, but you do it in a patient that shouldn't have gotten that block, even though you do the block correctly, right? So you can, it's not enough that the information is right. You want to make sure you put it in context. Now, someone who's been in practice for 20 years can probably listen to a podcast or watch a video and put that in the context of their 20 years of practice and learning. Whereas a brand new CA1 might not yet have the context within anesthesiology to fit that. So you want to just take that into account and be careful. And again, when you learn something new or interesting, look into it, learn more about it, don't act on it right away. I think that's really the key. And then I think the last thing that people would say is, you know, with things, as things change, what happens to things that are already out there? Now, I think there are pros and cons. A blog, you of course, unlike a published article, which once it's published is done, right? It's, you can't go back and unpublish it and then republish it in a different format. You can publish a new one. A blog you can change, but you don't know if people are changing it. So you might have something, and you actually mentioned this before, that might have been right at some time, which there's new evidence that hasn't actually been updated in there. So you just have to put that into context. Think about when it was published. And it always drives me crazy, by the way, when you know, a blog or a website of any kind doesn't have a date on a given entry, right? I mean, how do I know when you put that in there? Was it 10 years ago or was it 10 days ago? So I think knowing when it was published and trying to take that into account as well. I'm sure there are other cons to this stuff that people are going to bring up. I have one of my APDs will tell you that the fact that people think they no longer need textbooks because of all this stuff that's out there, she thinks is a big loss. I'm not convinced that you have to read a textbook to learn and do well in learning and becoming an anesthesiologist or any other kind of physician. I think that you can't just do question bank questions. But I think if you really delve into what's out there and you know, use a lot of different resources, and when you find something you're not sure about or you get a question wrong, you read carefully the explanations and look at the sources. And, you know, I think you can cover the same stuff that you would get in a textbook that way. But some people might say that the ubiquity of all this other stuff pulling people away from textbooks is a con. I'm not sure I agree with that.
Well, it's as a last thing, I don't want to, you know, take up too much of your time, is one of the most interesting things about, you know, being a content creator is people who will call me out on something or say, I've never heard this before. I saw this somewhere. And like, I have to go back. Like, I know I read about this in, you know, the Kaplan cardiac book, like, or they'll send me a paper. I'm like, I did not know about this paper that came out 6 months ago that, you know, changed everything. You know, but how many people still say, don't use any pressors and flaps? It's like the meta-analyses for the last two decades all say it doesn't matter.
Yep, absolutely. Well, David, let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Anything you have that you'd like to recommend that people check out?
I saw Dr. Pera mentioned Ted Lasso, which was, you know, a thought of mine, which is fantastic. Recently, I've watched The Witcher. If anybody hasn't seen it, it was based off of a book and then a subsequent video game about a guy that hunts monsters. And it's Henry Cavill, who plays Superman. I don't know. I like fantasy and sci-fi, and it's you know, something that I watched with the new season coming out. I'm very excited for it.
Nice. The Witcher, as in W-I-T-C-H-E-R?
Yes, sir.
And what where can people find that? What network or
Netflix.
Channel? Netflix. All right, great. Well, that's awesome. I'm always interested in having new shows to check out, so thanks for that recommendation. I know I said this up front, but I just want to reemphasize again that my recommendation is going to be to check out the Snack website, snack.org, their podcast, the new Snack podcast. You know, it's well done. There's a lot of great resources. I think neuroanesthesia is something that people are going to see in any anesthesiology residency, and many people are going to do a lot in practice. So this is, again, a free, really nice resource for people to check out. All right. Well, David, this has been great. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Dr. Wolpaw, it's my pleasure. I hope we keep in touch. Maybe at the next big conference, I finally get to, you know, meet you after years of speaking intermittently.
I look forward to it. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Zach.
All right. That was great. I hope you enjoyed it and got a lot out of it. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com. Let us know what you thought of the show and what we've missed. What are you doing? What are you thinking about? What's out there that you really enjoy from a social media standpoint? You can leave a comment so everyone can learn from what you have to say. You can also follow us on Instagram, on Facebook, and on Twitter. We're at ACRAG Podcast, and I'm at Jay Wolpaw. If you're a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. Also, if you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAG. That's patreon.com/ACCRAC, where you can become a patron of the show and pledge whatever you want per episode. And we really appreciate that. Of course, you can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who've already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. It makes a huge difference. Huge thanks, as always, to our amazing ACRAC team. Dr. Brian Park is our tech lead. Brian Okonski is our social media manager. And Drs. Kimia Kashkuli and April Liu are our production assistants. Thanks, as always, to Dr. Dennis Kuo, who composed our original ACRAC music. And you can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast and Dr. David Konvisar, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.